right, you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio for another Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, the Wall Street whiz kid, Peter Grandich. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you, sir.
You know, I'd like to begin today's discussion with some recent comments from your website. You say that the metals are not yet ready to move dramatically higher. Nevertheless, the price action is certainly much less bearish than in 2011. Please elaborate.
Yeah, obviously by now anybody that's been in the metals know we've had a terrible couple years from basically a straight-up market that went up for 12 years. It's been basically a market that has been driven lower far more in the paper market than any large-scale physical selling. We know that physical buying is net further ahead than it was in 2011, yet the price has come off, and that's been driven mostly because of what takes place in the paper market. And forgetting for a moment whether that selling that takes place in the paper market is manipulated or not, just looking at it in itself, what we've been witnessing, at least what I believe we've been witnessing, is a dissipation of the strength of those parties or party that has led the decline lower. In other words, the power, the ability to drive it lower, the length of time, the amount of buying or, in this case, selling interest, are all waning, particularly as each decline that has occurred over the last 3 to 6 months, which is suggesting to me and why I wrote about on the website that while I don't think that just means we go straight up because we no longer go down anymore, the overwhelming number of bears and, most importantly, much of the financial media that gives them carte blanche to state their bearish ways are losing the ability to take the market substantially lower. And logic suggests, although sometimes it seems that gold trades illogically, but logic suggests that once you put an end to a movement that's been going on for quite a while in one way, eventually it's going to lead to a move in the opposite direction. And that's why, while I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, I do think it's the beginning of the process that eventually leads us to a new sustained move.
You demonstrate that, I think, quite well with the GAN angle work. I'd like to get to your GAN work in a minute. For our technically minded folks here, the work of GAN, I believe those angles are spaced via the golden mean. That's the Greek letter phi, the Fibonacci sequence. We see this pattern all throughout nature. But before we get to that, I'd like to talk to your carte blanche or blank check analogy. We're seeing signs of strength in the markets, but you know, the bad guys, the bears, they also have a blank check. They've got the printing presses, they have derivatives, and you know, gold and silver are still relatively small markets compared to even one or two major components of the Dow Jones Industrials. I wonder if you could give us an idea about how the powers that be are apparently manipulating these markets, and talk a bit about gold rigging, please.
I've been in a camp, and I've been in that camp for several years, not as early as when some group like GATA was formed, but certainly it became evident that selling, not for just the sake of selling, but contrived to cause end results other than just somebody looking to get out of something was apparent in both the gold and silver market. We've had maybe not quite smoking guns, but we've had a lot of evidence that suggests that one can make it. Then we believe we've seen some smoking guns. I think in most recent times, and I think it's one of the reasons, by the way, that we're seeing the lessening of the downside pressure is the actual news that's taken place most recently regarding the gold London fix, and that it's ironic, and I don't think it's coincidental. First, there's accusations that there's a fix on the fix, and before you know it, four of the six guys that used to be involved in the fixing are dropping out. And, you know, I've been around long enough and know that that's not coincidental. They just decided to leave. So there is a manipulation. Is the manipulation something where people sit together on a Sunday evening and discuss it? I don't know if that's the case, But what I do think has happened, and this is probably even among those who believe and have been ardent about the manipulation, have not spoken enough about, is that once you do something enough times, it actually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And what I mean by this is, I don't think everybody that's in the paper market is involved in the manipulation, but they've been around the block. And it's kind of like from the old movie for people that watch The Trading Places, when they notice the two brothers are on the floor trading and they were just traders themselves, they run in because they got to figure if they're there, it's only going one way, whatever they're doing. And what I think has happened is, because the market, as you noted, is relatively small compared to others, the players within it kind of know that there's certain people or groups that when they start to act, almost 100% of the time, the market, at least for a short period of time, heads that way, and it actually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that's been part of the contributing factor to why we have these downside moves, and we never seemingly get the same type of results to the upside. So do I think each and every day a group of people get together and manipulate gold and silver? No, I do not. Do I believe governments, central banks, and significant players have used and taken advantage of the market not only to profit personally from what it does, but also the reaction it may give to give cause and effect in other places? Absolutely, I believe that.
No, I think their fingerprints and footprints are all over the market. We can see this on very specific moments where there are clear signs of a gold and silver raid, not only in the charts, but during specific key moments. It might be when an economic number is announced, perhaps after the gold fix in the, you know, every day they still have a gold fix, of course, that stems from London. So I think you make a great point there. Also wanted to move on to your technical work. You know, it's interesting, these GAN angle lines we briefly spoke about. Fibonacci sequence is an interesting pattern in them. And even if they weren't spaced by any specific pattern, when we start to see the downtrend lose its momentum, these GAN fans, as some people call them, tend to be broken. And that's a sign of strength. Please tell us more about your work in this area.
Yeah, it is. I am by no stretch of the imagination a technical analyst. And nor is it ever normally the first and most important decision-making, whether when I was an advisor or for my own self. But I like to look at it because many times I like to get technical analysis, hopefully to confirm or disprove what I'm thinking fundamentally. And as you noted, and if people can imagine a fan, once you start to see a couple of two or more downtrend lines being broken to the upside, and of course vice versa works as well, it is suggested historically, percentage-wise, it's favorable that is suggesting that a change in direction is afoot. The other thing that isn't often used much anymore by people, and that is the spread or the width between, say, a moving average and an uptrend line or a moving average and a downtrend line. And historically, when there's a certain amount of distance between them, markets have become overextended and they tend to move back towards moving averages. John Bollinger, who was a very popular technician who I used to appear on television a lot with back even before CNBC when it was Financial News Network, created many years something called the Bollinger Bands, and much of that was to show people that historically, markets tend to move more times than not closer to moving averages. There's sometimes when there's great volatility and they get out of that. And so Bollinger Bands are another area that a lot of people don't use that I use. And when you combine them all of them were now suggesting that this 2 to 3 year, call it severe correction or bear market in gold, whatever you want, all the momentum indicators, or most of them that these things suggest, are waning to the downside. I still say with an asterisk, because I still believe there are manipulators out there, that there can still be one more move to the downside. But chances are we're seeing the end of it, but the market isn't ready to support, you know, a dramatic 20 or 30% move up in a couple months yet either. So I just think we're just in a change of seasons. take the winter jacket off yet, but don't break out the suntan lotion yet, you know, if you're bullish on gold.
You know, I remember you and John Bollinger on FNN in those days, and then, of course, CNBC, and you are correct. You know, what I found in my work, one of the more reliable indicators is based on Bollinger Bands, but it really has nothing to do visually with the Bollinger Bands. That's the Bollinger Band percent. There's another derivative of the Bollinger Bands, and it tends to give a really solid indication at overbought and oversold levels. From that metric, you're absolutely right. We're way oversold, on, especially in the XAU, but maybe that's a topic for later in the discussion. What I wanted to talk about next, if we could, is the tapering situation. We just recently had our fourth tapering, bringing us down, I guess, around $40 billion a month in Fed stimulus. So they're cutting way back there. And clearly, they're quite hawkish. Most of the comments coming from the Fed governors and the Fed chair, it seems to indicate that we will wrap up this QE program no later than this year, and then begin the long, slow, arduous process of increases in the Fed overnight lending rate, the benchmark. Could you give us some of your thoughts on how this will play out and how in the world this economic patient is going to remain upright when the Fed pulls all of its stimulus measures away?
Well, I think your last sentence there is the key of everything that you were leading up to, and that is, if indeed the tremendous increase we've seen in the Fed balance sheet, which, by the way, the tapering doesn't do anything to lower that. It's just lowering the amount that they've been adding to that. And there's been great discussion now it could take several years, if not 10 years or more, before the Fed could even reduce its balance sheet to something more normal, what it was before all these QE started. I think what the $64,000 question, although it doesn't look like when you look at the stock market in recent days, is take away the punch bowl, so to speak, and we've had, at best, and I think bulls will have to agree, at least if they had to put their hand on a Bible and say the truth, that we've had anemic growth despite all this QE. So if the QE is being taken away, what other than hope and conjecture, which is even our newest Fed chairperson has taken the place of Bernanke to keep talking about how the second half of the year is going to be better, and that's been the case for about 8 years now, that the second half is going to be better, but never really does. What's going to drive it? How has the U.S. economy become self-sustaining that you don't need this Fed action? And that's why some of us, I think, remain very skeptical that while this may be tapering may even continue to the point where for a very short period of time there is no extra stimulus, eventually, because of how poor overall the economy really is underneath what the Dow Jones Industrial may be saying today, is that they'll be back to some sort of quasi-QE program. It won't be the same as before, so they don't say that they failed in what they did. And that's the big question, and that's the concern that I have as a very staunch bear now, that the U.S. economy, we borrowed so much from the future. We created trillions and trillions of dollars that in some way, shape, or form will have to be paid back or reneged or renegotiated. For what? What actual growth or what sustainability, what do we have that's actually better than before QE1 started? Well, where can we point to in areas of the economy or even sections of the country and say, look at them there. They are definitely significantly ahead to where they were 5 years ago. Everywhere we look in any area of the country, we see states with terrible underfunding of pension liabilities, a discussion, again, that isn't brought up each day. We see infrastructure crumbling. More importantly, and what's made news of late, and I've tried to focus on my website, is people don't understand the tremendous difficulty we have, not only from terrorism of our electric grid, but just the failing of the electric grid, and to continue without spending hundreds of billions of dollars to meet the needs and services of electricity to grow the economy over the next couple of decades. And so there's a whole variety of things while Wall Street is still caught up that it's, you know, as long as the Fed is your friend, you can't lose, you got to be in. But everything else around, I don't see how anybody can legitimately point and say the American economy is as good or even better than it was before QE1 was kicked off.
Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog puts out at least one or two fantastic articles a week now for several years on the economy, and he shows without any doubt that over 102 million Americans who are of working age and able-bodied are not working right now, are unemployed. Just an astounding number when you think about the fact that that's roughly half of the available workforce is sitting idle. Some of those people maybe don't want to work, and others simply have given up all hope altogether. They're underemployed, but there is simply no way that a country can sustain itself, I think you'd agree, when one out of three of its working, able-bodied folks are simply sitting on the couch watching TV and surfing the internet. So, I mean, this is just one metric that's startling. Another one that I think would back up your comments are we're losing right now, according to the same author, roughly 500,000 top industrial jobs per year. Of course, that adds up quickly. We're approaching 6 million high-paying, very strong benefit jobs in the industrial sector. We've lost over 6 million now since the year 2000. So, I mean, you start to add some of these numbers up and you begin to wonder, where is the economic engine that will support the economy once this life support system, when they pull the plug on that, again, you know, I guess we keep going around in circles here, but something has to give. That's going to be the question for 2015. How are we going to maintain our economic growth? I wanted to move on to some of your precious metals holdings. Maybe you could talk a bit about Sunridge Gold, please. This is one that you've had on your radar screen.
Well, in my own personal holdings, and it's one company that I still am engaged as a consultant to, not for investor relations, but for general other principal businesses. It is by far my largest holding ever in my life on any one thing. It is a company that is clearly made it known that besides moving forward on a planned production of a mostly copper zinc project with some gold in Eritrea, that it has been engaged also as concurrent with that in merger and activity discussions. Those, according to management, who I literally just spoke to a short time ago, has been more prevalent than since it first started. But part of that is, let's not forget that we still have a very real weak overall resource market. It's a shame because I look at this and imagine this company in the same place with the same structure 10 years ago, the share price would be at least five times higher than it currently is. But what a famous president says is what was, and what is. We have a much still difficult market, and we're not seeing valuations anything close to what we saw 10 years ago. Ironically, when metal prices were actually lower than they were now. So it is a company that is speculative. It's always the real word, which is gambling, and that speculation and gambling are both the same thing. And when you gamble, you need to be prepared to lose part or all your capital and the mental aspect that goes with that loss. But it is something that I think is very, very cheap here, especially since in recent weeks we've seen a pullback in a lot of the junior resource stocks yet again. And that's just because there's just still no real new big-time money coming into that sector yet. And like you stated earlier, and I agree with you when you noted about charts, that some of the major gold stocks are perhaps in the most oversold conditions that I've seen in the 30 years I've been in the business. And relative to what valuations are given totally for all of them versus the overall market are probably in the most undervalued state, even more so when gold was under $300 an ounce. And that's probably, like you would say, is a discussion for another interview. But that's how really to the overdone we've been to the downside. But there's not quite yet a spark to turn that. And it would not surprise me that the spark would eventually be a significant correction underway in the stock market that's even evident to the day-to-day talking heads, and then that money will flow into the mining share sector. So we're probably still at least days, if not weeks, if not a couple months away before we see a big lift up again in the mining shares.
I share your sentiment. Telling my listeners and subscribers that we're looking for higher highs on the Dow Jones, you know, week after week after week, the highest highs in recorded history in that index. And, you know, Peter, I'm sure you'd agree there's really only 30 components, albeit they're very large cap companies, but still, you know, not too difficult for the powers that be to manipulate 30 companies as opposed to, say, 500 companies on the S&P 500 or many, many thousand on the NASDAQ. A couple of comments on Sunridge Gold, the last pick you were referring to, penny stock, and you did say quite speculative, but I do agree with you that if we can take out 28, the sky's the limit on this company. Bottom building or a base building, you can see in the charts clearly now for over a year. So very positive sign there, if, and that's the proviso, if we can take out 28 there. I wanted to talk a bit about the top story driving the markets lately, other than domestically, you know, on the geopolitical scene. Clearly, we've seen a lot of nervousness coming from, you know, the Crimea situation initially, and now Ukraine, and it's sort of a hotbed there. Do you think that the markets are, the equities markets, are discounting this situation at their own peril? You know, there's been a lot of talk that this could lead to a Cold War-like scenario and a standoff between the West and Russia. I'd like your thoughts, please.
Well, I don't think geopolitical concerns have impacted the general equity market for several years. I think, while my personal opinion, and some will disagree with this, this president has done more to hurt America on the world stage as a political and an important power, if not the world power, if it still is or if it's running second these days, than the last 10 presidents combined. Yet the talking heads and the general people that play on Wall and Broad don't include geopolitical concerns about when they talk about markets, which is really strange only because, if you think about it, from when I entered 30 years ago to now, we are a global economy, and what happens around the world does impact. There's no more the oceans that separate us on the West Pacific and the East, the Atlantic, don't keep us separated from what happens in other places of the world economically anymore. And yet such little time is spent by the majority of what I've always liked to coin the "don't worry, happy crowd" on Wall Street on really how poorly America stands now in the world stage. I mean, when I entered the business in 1984, I honestly believed I could look at one hand and name countries where, wow, they really don't like us or really don't want to have anything to do with us. Now I take the same hand. I think maybe I could use four or five of the fingers of the countries that really still like us a lot and welcome us with open arms. And I don't understand how they don't consider that in their thinking, because so many companies are doing business worldwide and we're not among the favorites and we're not the first choice of people, well, how are these American companies going to do well in those countries? And so it's just another of the plastic bubble world that Wall Street is in. And unfortunately, when it bursts, all these things will come to bear. And then the net results of all these years of neglect and appeasement and losing military proudness and allowing what took place in Benghazi without, you know, a year ago or over, the president said they'll be brought to justice and nothing's happened and ambassadors are killed and Americans are attacked and stories come out later that administrations are not telling the truth when they're trying to explain what happened. And all these things have become unimportant and unrelative to a market. They always, if history tends to repeat itself, eventually do. So it's just all part of this, for lack of a better word, bubble world that Wall and Broad lives in right now. But the pin is there, and when it bursts, it's only a question of when and from what level, it's going to be a very tough payback, and it's not going to be something, quite frankly, in my opinion, that ends in a short time. And I really think if you thought 2008 was bad, this next one is going to be a lot harsh, and it's going to last for a lot longer. So I hope I'm wrong, but when I go to sleep at night, and if I had to say my last words to my wife, I tell her I believe I'm going to be right, and of course have prepared ourselves for that.
And, you know, the question I think that comes to mind is, the next 2008 credit crisis-like disaster, just what do they have left in the arsenal? You know, what's left to throw at that problem? I mean, we're going to be talking about derivatives, a mountain of derivatives that makes, you know, $1 trillion, even maybe $250 billion, sound like, you know, walking around money, and are pulling away from the stimulus. And we've already talked about this, so I won't go into it too much. But I mean, what do they have left? So, I mean, it's going to be quite a showdown. And speaking of showdowns, the only thing I would add to your geopolitical talk, China now is on track to become the number one economy. And I know you can remember just a few years ago, they were battling for third and fourth place. And now they're going to overtake the United States as the world's most robust economy. And guess who is neighbor to China and very good standing with China? You know, their northern friends, Russia. We, the West, are going to put sanctions against Russia. And, you know, we're rattling sabers constantly with China. This is just a collision course that I don't think our officials want to put us on. And maybe that is a topic for another day. And so as we wrap up, I wonder if you could tell folks more about what you're watching. Are there any other topics that I failed to cover today, please?
Like you said, I think the equity market's in an extremely dangerous zone. I think it's very important, and you just touched on it when you were making some comments, that when you get past the Dow Jones and even the S&P, there's a lot weaker market, and that's just another signal that the pin is coming close to bursting the bubble. I think the other thing that has not gotten much attention, and what people seem to forget, is that we were just told a couple of months ago that the only reason the economy was real bad in the first quarter is we had a harsh winter, and that brought everybody in, and then an employment number came out, which was highly questionable, but still drove, and everything was hunky-dory. Well, we had retail sales this morning that were very, very disappointing, and they were at a period of time when the harsh winter was past us, and if we were down because of a harsh winter, the pent-up demand should have showed up in those numbers. People would have rushed out to get what they couldn't get for the 3 months due to the bad weather. So I just think we're in a very dangerous zone. It doesn't mean that they can't make it a little bit more and go a little bit further. But I think, you know, there's, you know, 3-5% to the upside, and there's 20, 30, 40, even 50% to the downside over the next several years. And I just don't like to play that game that we played as kids when they kept taking one chair away and one less person was in the game, and somehow think I'm going to be the luckiest one and end up with the only one with the chair. I've exited, and somebody said, well, maybe you got out too early, and I'll leave this with you. And that is, it's a saying that after 30 years I try to live by. I'd rather be a year too early than a day too late.
When the music stops, who wants to get caught holding that potato, that hot potato? And I think your point is well made, because when we look not only at equities, but at the precious metals, if we can extend your analogy to gold and silver and the equities especially, you know, what is the downside risk here? Another 5 or 10%? Okay, but what is the upside opportunity? I think that's where we have to start focusing our efforts here. As always, Peter Grandich, we want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule for us today. Just a treasure trove of knowledge. Could you tell folks more about what you're working on? I mean, we really need to direct them over to moneytalks.net.
Sure. Just go to moneytalks.net and look at Peter's column, and that's where I write my commentaries. It's free. You can sign up for an email alert that comes there. I'll write about other things that they can learn about the other businesses. But I also want to say, Chris, I never get a chance to say this to you because we always hang up, is one of the main reasons I love doing your interviews is you know what you're talking about, and it's a pleasure to talk with people and know what they're talking about versus some of the reporters out there that speak to you. And without the teleprompter, they'd be totally lost. So it's always a pleasure to speak to you as well.
Your comments are much appreciated, and I just hope that folks will remember that it's really Peter Spina and the great folks at GoldSeek.com that make it possible, because if we didn't have their support, you know, this show would just fall to the wayside. Peter Grandich, it's always great talking with you.
Thank you.